and welcome to 15 Minutes in DC. I'm Hayley Channer, Senior Policy Fellow with the Perth US Asia Centre. Today, my guest is Misha Zielinski. Misha is a special correspondent with the Australian Financial Review, and up until a few months ago, he was covering Russia's invasion of Ukraine from Ukraine, including in Kiev and later Lviv. Misha is also a 2021 Fulbright Scholar, where he was based in Washington, D.C., with two think tanks, and he is the Assistant National Secretary of the Australian Workers' Union and Secretary of the Australian Labor Party's National Policy Forum. People may also know Misha from his podcast, Diplomates, a Geopolitical Chinwag. Misha, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So obviously, my questions for you are going to focus on your recent experience in Ukraine. Cool. And I think a lot of people, the first question they ask when they reflect on the war in Ukraine and Russia's actions is, could it have been prevented, and could, for lack of a better term, the so-called West have stopped this from happening? I actually don't think that that's the most interesting question because, and we can debate this, but I don't think there is something the West could have done differently to stop the invasion. So my more interesting...
I disagree, but we can come back to it.
Oh, tell me. Tell me then.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, look, Putin had been learning lessons over many years, and up until now, all of his behaviour had gone unpunished, essentially. You know, if we wanted Ukraine specific, you know, the annexations were basically a slap across the wrist of taking Crimea and starting a civil war backed by Russian forces in the eastern part of Ukraine in Donbass, you know, shooting down MH17. Mm. And so, you know, I think had Putin really understood what was about to happen to his military, to his economy, and truly believed that would happen, I think perhaps the outcome may have been different. Now, he might have done it anyway, right? I mean, you know, Putin has said this is a red line for him, any concept of Ukraine turning west rather than east. But I would have thought if he truly understood the menu of things coming his way, and also had we in the West, I think, been less concerned about what Vladimir Putin cares about in terms of, oh, we couldn't possibly arm Ukraine now. You know, all the weaponry they now have, if they had that in their hands before the war, and Putin had to put that into his calculus, I think that also may have caused, given him cause for pause. He probably didn't know that his military would be so inept. Mm. I don't think anybody knew that, and we talk about that. But I think, you know, you need to understand, you know, behavior and consequences and risk analysis. A lot of that comes down to, well, what I think is likely to happen. And up until now, the West has been very had no appetite for upsetting Vladimir Putin. Mm. And, you know, I thought, well, I can get away with it again. He gambled and lost on this occasion. You know, the gamble was we're going to take Kiev in 24 hours, new government, decapitate the Zelensky government, have Zelensky marching down the street in chains, new person in charge, sign a peace treaty with the Russians, get invited in. His tanks are now sitting in, you know, central Kiev and says, come get me. Now, and that's the one scenario I think maybe he would have been right, because it wasn't until a few days of the fighting, because everyone thought, oh, well, Ukraine is going to get knocked over in a day here, right? And I was obviously sitting there hoping not that would not happen, but, you know, that was the view, and so there was no point arming them. And then only as everyone started to go, well, hang on, they're going all right here. Mm. You know, there was, an enormous battle for the Andropov airport, which was critical to stop the Russian advance having an air bridge into the city. But, you know, the fighting spirit of the Ukrainians is what turned this around and suddenly gave the West, with all our resources and everything we have at our disposal, the confidence to actually, you know, actually put some pressure on Putin finally. Mm. And now he's bearing those consequences. So, you know, you couldn't have changed Putin's want to invade Ukraine, but he may have calculated it differently. We don't know, of course. I mean, man's insane, so who knows?
Well, I mean, hindsight too is always 20/20. Totally. And I guess there is that argument, just playing devil's advocate, sure, that, you know, people that didn't realise Ukraine would put up such a fantastic fight, that if they had armed them before the conflict, that you could have just been prolonging something that was already going to be inevitable in terms of Russia taking Ukraine. But let's park that for a minute.
No, totally. I didn't mean to jump straight in because you said it's not the most interesting, but
I didn't think it was. Look, you've proved me wrong, so thank you for that.
Well, I don't know if I've proven anything, but I've certainly given a view, but anyway.
Look, what I wanted to ask was, this question about can you actually negotiate with dictators like Putin? Because obviously Putin is just one of many people around the world who you can't predict their actions, and sometimes what they do doesn't make any sense to to people in democratic, free countries. And, yeah, you touched on before the fact that, you know, Putin probably doesn't know how badly his military is going. But is there any way to actually negotiate with dictators so that in future we can prevent this kind of conflict from happening?
Well, I think, you know, coming back to my original comments, is you need to have demonstrated consequences for bad behavior. So I think what the West got very bad at was defending our values. So saying, okay, if this happens, X will happen, and then X doesn't happen, you become a paper tiger at that point, right? And so I think you need to be very clear to say, well, we will defend these values if you breach territorial integrity of another sovereign nation. We're going to provide support to that country. Or, you know, if you want to use the Ukrainian example, obviously there's parallels there to Taiwan. But generally speaking, up until now, the autocrats have been getting away with perhaps in many cases literal murder, but metaphorical murder as well. And so, you know, I think for a long time, a lot of people in the West have not wanted to deal with this reality. It's an uncomfortable reality. When I started talking about rise of autocrats, you know, in the middle part of last decade, people didn't want to hear it. Everyone still wanted this peaceful rise mantra. And what ended up happening is we believe that liberal Western democracy with liberal economics would liberalize the world. It didn't happen. What happened was autocrats got rich and then weaponized that against us, and we were no longer prepared to defend the value. So we end up with was essentially valueless markets.
Rhetoric.
No, valueless capitalism, right? And so saying, okay, as long as the money's right, then who cares, right? And that's where everyone was looking the other way, like in many parts of the world. And, you know, I think there's a return now to some form of, you know, defense of values. And we talk about, you know, why democracies aren't doing well later. But generally speaking, I think it's to say, okay, bad guys only understand outcomes, right? They're outcomes focused, fine. They don't have values, or their values are different than ours. And you're right, playing this sort of rationality, you know, Putin would say, oh, he's irrational. Well, you know, depends on how you play that. Mm. But if he understood, listen, you're going to get kicked out of SWIFT payment system. We're going to freeze all the assets of the entire Russian Reserve Bank. Every single one of your oligarchs is going to be locked in this panic room nation of yours. You know, we're going to arm Ukraine with these things. Okay. And let me tell you, it will happen. Not, you know, and so I think that that is really the only way. But also I'd say probably the other way, and is really sticking together. Mm-hmm. And NATO has done that. The old West, if you want to call it that, has done that. Now there's parts of, if I said, oh, the whole world's against Russia. Well, not quite. The old Western alliance is against Russia. And, you know, some of the autocrats are kind of backing in Putin. And then the new world, if you want to call it that, Southeast Asia, Africa, they're kind of sitting it out. And I think that that is where a lot of the work is required. But building unity with other countries, strength in numbers, I'm a unionist, is the way to do it as well.
Mm. That question, though, that arises for me after listening to you is that, you know, Ukraine is not a member of NATO and that countries are really only galvanized to assist Ukraine after they saw that it was withstanding Russia's force. And you don't know what's going to happen in the future for other countries that invade a sovereign nation and try and take it over. So it's like a chicken and egg thing where you can't really tell what the outcome will be. So you can't get countries galvanized towards one cause because you can't predict what's going
to
happen.
Well, you can't make people want to defend themselves. So I think it's always important to bet on people that want to be free, right? I think one of the biggest problems when you compare perhaps Ukraine to Afghanistan, you know, the collapse there was precipitous because there was an army defending a nation state that no one really agreed existed. Whereas Ukraine, you know, there is a real strong sense of nationhood, civil, you know, connectivity, you know, history, belief in the nation state of Ukraine, the Ukrainian language, et cetera. And so they're prepared to defend it with their lives. And so, you know, it is difficult to predict it, but I do think also, you know, we should lean towards, you know, if people say they want to defend themselves, we should help them do that. But also I think being clear about what we are prepared to do. So we don't know what a sovereign nation will do in defense of itself. And they decide, no, we would rather not fight. We can't make them fight, right? But if they say that they're prepared to, we should give them the tools to do that. But be very clear with the aggressor, here's what's likely to happen. Now, but you look at you talk about NATO, the consequence of that is that Sweden and Finland are joining NATO, which was unthinkable for them to do this, right? And why are they doing that? Strength in numbers. And they, you know, and so Putin doesn't want to take on NATO to prepare to bully Ukraine. And so they're kind of making the rational assessment, oh, well, I want to get in the club that, yeah, that Putin's afraid of.
So just going back to that point you made about Afghanistan, do you think because the United States had just literally come out of Afghanistan in August after sort of a 20-year conflict, that there was a real hesitation to do anything on Ukraine before it happened, or that there was an expectation perhaps like other Ukrainians had that no war was actually going to happen and so there was no attempt to prevent it from happening?
I mean, I think there's like a lot you can talk about in terms of the reasons for not wanting to defend Ukraine. Clearly, it's a, no one wants a hot war with Russia, right? They are a military power. They're a nuclear power. They're the only country apart from the United States which can literally destroy the world. And so, you know, there's good cause to be cautious when dealing with Russia, but that doesn't mean you should be, you know, essentially obsequious to them either, right? But I definitely think one thing I would say about Iraq and Afghanistan is that it really has undermined Western credibility. Those wars, I think most people would agree, certainly the Iraq war, were mistakes and were predicated on phony intelligence or phony objectives and went very badly for the United States and its allies, and really damaged credibility. And Putin really does use that as a way to say, well, you guys went into Iraq to reshape a threat that you didn't like, and well, Ukraine's on our doorstep, and these Nazis, you know, he sort of alleges they're not, but nevertheless, he says, well, I've got Nazis on my doorstep. I've got to get rid of them. Yeah. And so, you know, unfortunately, that has probably been one of the big factors, I think. But yeah, I think that also those 20-year forever wars, as they're called by some people, drained the will to fight as well. You know, long wars drain nations. They drain of treasure, blood, and will. And so, you know, overseas adventurism hasn't really got a good brand. And so I think that was definitely a factor as well, yeah.
It's always hard to predict the future, but in thinking about forever wars, the war in Ukraine has been going for more than 3 months now. Mm. I mean, I really hope this isn't early days in the war, but are you expecting, based on what we've seen, that this could drag on for years potentially?
Certainly possible. Look, you know, in this modern world, 100 days, you know, where's the outcome, right? And so everyone thinks, like, well, how's it all going to end? Well, I think we know that Ukraine won't be conquered. Russia lost the battle for Kyiv, then basically lost the battle for Kharkiv. So their objectives, we don't really know what they are, but they have shifted over 100 days. And that's a bad sign if you're Putin. You know, you had to change your objectives a number of times, and he's sustaining huge levels of loss. But Russia is still a significant military power. You know, they've got real struggles in their supply chains, rebuilding their tanks, etc. But nevertheless, they can really bombard Ukraine for as long as they want, almost. And, you know, the thing I've said for a long time is that even while losing a war, Putin can destroy Ukraine. And that's a real fear here. And he's doing the Russian approach of indiscriminately destroying cities like Mariupol. Mm-hmm. It's horrific. But the war really now is in a, I don't like to use this term, but people phrase it, you know, a grinding phase of the war essentially means, you know, high levels of attrition in a concentrated area, a lot of people losing their lives in the eastern part of the country. The war is now basically on a 75-kilometre front in the southeastern part of the country and not really moving a great deal. Now, that's a good sign for the Ukrainians. It shows you the Russians, even when they're concentrating, their forces are struggling to make huge advances. But, you know, the Ukrainians are going to have to probably dig in for a long time. But it is also worth pointing out that Russia occupies a huge amount of Ukrainian territory. They got 20% of Ukraine's land mass, which, you know, overlay that on a map of Europe, you know, about the size of Italy and other countries, right? So bigger than, you know, Britain. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is a huge land mass. And so the idea that the West can, NATO allies, start saying, oh, we don't want to embarrass or humiliate Putin, the Ukrainians need to think about a deal. Well, you know, would we give away Queensland in Australia because, you know, someone decided it was part of their country, you know, in some ancient empire? I wouldn't have thought so. And so, you know, you can understand why that kind of inverted commas deal is unpalatable at home. Now, Zelensky, he said he wants a peace and we should all hope for a peace, but a peace shouldn't be on Russia's terms. They started this war. It's a war of choice. And so I think as long as it's a peace that Ukraine's comfortable with, then we should strive towards that because we want to see people not dying. But, you know, I certainly don't support people that say we should fight to the last you know, Ukrainian drop of Ukrainian blood, you know. Like, it's, we can't sit here and make that assessment. But if they want to keep fighting and defending themselves, then we should continue to supply that effort. But We don't know. The truth is we don't know, but I do think it's, you know, it's hard to see a situation where Ukraine is conquered by Russia at this point, given that they've now exhausted themselves in many ways and they've lost so much of their good kit, so many of their good soldiers. You know, they've lost their flagship vessel, which is the first time that's happened to anyone since Argentina in the Falklands War. So, like, the Russian performance is extraordinarily bad, but nevertheless, Putin, you know, it's got a pretty good toehold in the southern eastern parts of the country, and he's not going to give them up in a hurry. So a frozen conflict certainly possible. You know, it is possible you may end up in a situation where the real hot part of the war doesn't continue on in many ways.
What I wanted to ask was, do you actually think that there are useful or relevant, credible lessons from what is happening in Ukraine that we can draw on for our own Indo-Pacific region? Or do you think they're, you know, completely separate and they would be unrelated and have absolutely no bearing on the likelihood of China doing anything similar in the Indo-Pacific?
Well, I think firstly, you know, we're studying Ukraine, right? So the West, what are the lessons for the West out of Ukraine? And we've sort of unpacked a few of them already, but also be sure that the Chinese Communist Party is studying this conflict very carefully and the Western response to it thus far and making its calculations accordingly. And so Xi Jinping's made it very clear that they see Taiwan as a renegade province. You know, they don't see it as an island democracy of 20-odd million people. A lot of people say democracy is impossible in China, so we'll take a look at Taiwan. That's what democratic China looks like, right? But, you know, the lessons, I think, are, again, yeah, give them the capacity to defend themselves now, not in the event of a hot war, doing it now. But I think the calculation is an interesting one. Personally, you know, the wars on paper don't quite necessarily turn out like wars with live ammunition. And, you know, Vladimir Putin had this 24-hour strategy that I'm sure he sold Xi Jinping on when they were there at the Winter Olympics, when they signed their forever partnership, saying, you know, it'll be all over quickly, look at my plan. And the other regime that's got a similar 24-hour strategy, a blitzkrieg strategy, if you want to use that term, is the CCP in terms of taking out Taiwan. Now, you know, I'm not an absolute military expert, but essentially their strategy looks a little bit something like this: continue to push the American fleet further and further away from mainland China and Taiwan through carrier-killing missiles, et cetera, get them out past the first island chain, launch a really quick assault onto Taiwan, be on the land, and say, come get us. In America, at that point, its allies would have to decide whether or not they want to stage a land war in Taiwan. Very hard decision for anyone to make. But of course, you know, a 24-hour strategy doesn't always play out the way you want. And if you had to take a bet before and said, of the two, between Ukraine and Taiwan, which country or which, I don't know, it's a country because of Taiwan, but which government has the capacity to defend itself for longer, you would have said the Taiwanese, who are far better armed and far better prepared. And also, they've got a maritime border. Land wars are far easier to conduct than maritime invasions. And so it'd be giving the Chinese, I think, cause for a pause. And also, I think that, you know, as I said, if we'd been clearer with Putin about what the consequences would be, he may have calculated differently. Well, Xi Jinping and others now know the consequences. And so, and the, you know, the costs would be higher in many ways because you know, Russia's economy, whilst it's important as an energy economy to Europeans, it's really not an important economy globally. You know, it provides some commodities, you know, food, et cetera, which we're seeing. But, you know, the Chinese economy is a far more central part. And so it would have more profound consequences for everyone economically. But strictly militarily, I think that there would be real concern. And, you know, looking again, you know, everyone always says, look, lessons of history don't apply to me because we would have done it differently or that was a different situation. So they'd look at the Russians and perhaps say, well, their army wasn't very good. Ours is great. We've got a lot more money and a lot more kit and equipment. They also haven't fought anywhere. There is no history of the PLA fighting for a very, very long time, really since they lost badly to the Vietnamese. And so, you know, we don't know, and they don't know either. And I think that that is an important thing. To have doubt in the minds of your opponent is a useful thing when you're looking at conflict.
Misha, it's been a delight to have you on the show. You really have so much knowledge and expertise to give. Thank you so much for joining me on 15 Minutes in DC.
Thank you so much.